Who do you hate? Who are you angry at? It is the end of any kind of left liberal alliance in American politics. There's no hope in changing the Democratic Party from within.
Is woke over?
Of course it's fucking over. We elected Donald Trump president a second time. Hopefully, President Xi, if you're watching this, I'm ready. I'm available. Put me in, coach. I'm ready to play. We are preparing the ground for you in this country. We are ready to collaborate. And just let's link and build, brother. Let's do it.
Welcome to Doomscroll. I'm your host, Joshua Citarella. My guest is Will Menaker, a host of the Chapo Trap House podcast and a co-author of the Chapo Guide to Revolution.
Look at AOC now. And, you know, like,
I was going to ask.
Whenever I'm critical of her, like, people crawl up my ass or whatever. And, like, I spent years probably, like, biting my tongue because I'm not trying to be, like, as reflexively, like, to shit on her as much as...
We need to differentiate the political program from whatever AOC is doing with this, like, bodies and space.
You know, recently, like, when she just lost her, like, oversight committee bid to head up that committee to a guy who's, like, 75 and has cancer. And I just see that and I think, good. Buy the ticket, take the ride. Because, like, I mean, this is what you wanted. This is what you wanted. So, like, I mean, and yeah, it was her on stage at the DNC saying they're working tirelessly for a ceasefire.
Give me a fucking break.
That to me was like that. That was, I mean, like, it's just like I rooted for her when she first got in office. But I was skeptical then, but now I don't have to be skeptical anymore. There isn't a hope in any of this.
Yeah.
There's no hope in changing the Democratic Party from within.
Why did Trump win the election?
Well, because more people voted for him than his opponent, Kamala Harris.
You don't say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really, it's a numbers game, really, at the end of the day. However, actually, in our system of government, it's actually the numbers you get from the state electors. But
yes.
But yeah, essentially, he got more delegates and votes than Kamala Harris. So, I mean, yeah, if you're looking for a reason why he won the election, I think it's because more people wanted him to be president than his opponent. Well, A, like, let's begin with Joe Biden not stepping down after the 2022 midterms. And he was just, it's like, you know, LBJ style said, I'm not seeking a second term. Hmm. And the Democrats had something like a real primary. The shambling corpse of the Democratic Party, just like, I mean, could there be a better representation of that for trying to pass off this, like, you know, obviously senile old man to be like their candidate, and then replacing him with Kamala Harris, who I think got a brief honeymoon of period people like of people just being like, oh, we don't have to vote for Joe Biden.
She got about a meme news cycle.
Yeah, yeah. She's brat, but then it was just. I mean, right. I think what it comes down to, like, I mean, like the easiest explanation is her and the Democratic Party that the infrastructure around her don't actually believe in anything. I mean, well, they do believe in certain things, like, you know, supporting Israel and Wall Street and their you know, like their donors, but like they essentially don't believe in anything. Hmm. And like, and you see a lot of that now in the sort of postmortems where people are just, they're stuck on this idea of messaging. You know, we got like our messaging is better, or like, you know, we need 10,000 Hassan Plakers. And the message follows the policy.
And 10,000 Hassan Pikers.
Yeah, yeah, let 1,000 Hassan Pikers win. They just think, like, if we can only have Hassan Piker with our politics, then, like, then we'd have the perfect vessel for our message. And the answer is, like, Hassan wouldn't be Hassan if he had the politics of, you know, Pod Save America.
Right.
They essentially ran this election as a campaign against Donald Trump, yes, who's, like, you know, the most dangerous evil man who's ever existed in American history. But they really did also run a campaign against their own base. And they ran a campaign to essentially demoralize their own base on behalf of this, like, an imaginary, like, tranche of voters that existed on their spreadsheets. And I think...
Who is that imaginary voter?
Like, you know, the moderate voter, or the Republican voter that's, you know, voted Republican their whole life but is uncomfortable with Donald Trump because of, you know, January 6th or Russia or blah, blah, blah. The list goes down. It's just like a campaign for anyone but, I don't know, like the base. They're like, you know, anyone like liberal or progressive or a young person in this country. They didn't give people anything to vote for. And why would anyone vote for Republican light when the full fat version is on offer and half the price. So, I mean, I think that's really what it comes down to. Like, the Democrats didn't offer anything to anyone. They don't believe in anything. And say what you will about Donald Trump and the MAGA Republican Party, but it's pretty clear, you know, what they're offering, what they offer the people they vote for, who vote for them, which is just, you know, that he may be, you know, a cocksucker and a liar, but like, he's our guy.
Yeah.
And like, he makes the people who hate you mad.
Right.
And he wins. So, and like, the other thing is that, like, having already been president once, the idea that he represents, like, you know, like, the end of democracy, or that he's like an American Hitler or something, it just, whether that's true or not, remains to be seen. But like, to sell it to the voters, it just, I don't think it has the same cachet, because like, he's already been president for 4 years.
Right. He didn't do like a, you know, a horrible genocide in the first term. So maybe maybe that's not going to happen in
yeah,
the second.
No, yeah, exactly.
Actually, it is going to happen in the second, but well, but not here.
Well, unfortunately, it was Joe Biden who did that in his first term in office. The two-party system has just, like, you know, like, people are just sick of it. People are tired of politics. And Donald Trump is entertaining. He's the guy on TV. And if he's your guy, you get to see him on TV, and you get to see him winning and winding up the people you hate.
Right.
And, you know, like, it just comes back to, like, Kamala Harris and the Democrats. Like, who do you hate? Who are you angry at? They're angry at Donald Trump, but like, I don't think that, like, a guy who's already been president, and like, outside of the, you know, committed MSNBC watchers, I just don't think that, like, it's a force that really, the people connect to you too much in their daily lives.
There's also margins among, as you mentioned, the, you know, traditional constituencies of the Democratic Party, uh-huh. of young people, people of color, the working class.
Just like here in New York City, just look at Queens.
They're all leaning more and more red.
You know, the only group that actually broke for Kamala more this election than last election was old white people.
Really?
Yeah. Was older white people. And like, that was who their message was for.
Wow.
So I guess it worked in that regard. Yeah. But like, in doing that, they happened to alienate just about everyone else in the country.
Right, right. There's talk of political realignment, mm-hmm. as people describe it. I have some skepticism towards this. Uh-huh. There's the emergence of what people call the new right, this GOP support for labor. And within that, there are various constituencies, some of which have important disagreements with each other. How do you understand this emergent faction, this group that people call the new right?
I don't take any of the political commitments seriously. Mm. Like, I don't think we're going to see a new right that is, let's say, opposed to American empire or for the working class outside of, you know, their political branding. But like, I understand it as a phenomenon that is, if Donald Trump has done nothing else in his, you know, time as a, like, the dominant political figure in this era of American history, I think like the thing he's done that's going to have the most long-reaching effects is that I think he has severed in the popular consciousness like the association between voting Republican and like wearing a suit and tie every day.
Right.
I want to use this term carefully, like. There's a countercultural element to,
yes.
to voting Republican now, that it's like, you know, like they can metabolize any kind of weird contradictory beliefs that happens to be like how most voters in this country think. And I just think like to the new right, to the extent that it exists at all, I mean, it's the old right. It's just like the same political commitments and obsessions. But like, I think they've managed to, through Donald Trump, like, rebrand into a kind of, you know, like, I don't know, slobs versus snobs thing, or like I said, just like he made it okay to be weird. He made it okay to be weird and vote Republican.
We're around the same age. The political realignment, so to speak, if this is indeed happening, corresponds to a shift in the priorities and values of the Democratic Party. How do you understand that shift within, let's say, the past 40 years of what happened to the Democrats, what they represented more so in the 1980s versus 2020, for example?
I think the Democrats have basically represented the same thing as long as I've been alive. I don't think there's been any big shift there. I just think people are finding that it's entirely lacking. I think they represent, you know, capital and empire, and in fact, more efficiently than the right wing does in a lot of ways. I mean, I think they stand for their donors. They stand for Wall Street, and they stand for, you know, American military empire. And I don't really know what's changed in terms of, I mean, maybe just like the language they use, maybe like, you know, post 2016, they talk about bodies and spaces and privilege and representation, but like what they stand for and who they represent, I same with the Republican Party. I don't see much. I just see like the characters that we see on TV has changed, and maybe the branding has shifted. But like, I mean, I see both political parties essentially basically representing the same interests they did when I was born. The New Deal was the dominant paradigm for most of the 20th century. And I think like that changed in the late 70s, where it was just like, it used to be that like, even if you were a Republican president or had a Republican Congress, they were still operating basically under the assumption that like the New Deal and what it created and the idea of like a big government or a government that like intervenes in the market on behalf of its voters is, you know, like you had to play by those rules. And then, you know, by the time I was born, that was pretty much done. And we've seen like a, you know, a steady erosion of the very idea that like that there is anything other than the market in our society. And I think both political parties are reflections of that ideological and economic system.
Yeah. Who represents the interests of labor now?
Podcasters.
That's
podcasters who wear Carhartt. No. I mean, like the labor unions, to the extent that they still exist in the private sector, and more so in the public sector, but like, yeah. Workers themselves, like it certainly isn't any political party in this country.
And I would imagine that you have very little faith in Trump actually governing as a populist in any capacity.
Well, you know, he still could surprise you. You know, look at his cabinet picks. They're all very strange, wild, and they really might surprise you.
He's kind of thrown us off the scent a little bit here. There's things, zigzagging across the spectrum with some of these picks.
No, I mean, I think the truth about Donald Trump is that, like, you know, he governed like any other Republican president would.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that, like, for his supporters and for people in the Democratic Party, I just, like, I don't think they can get around.
How did you first become politicized?
I mean, I don't know. Like, I grew up in a, you know, like a upper middle class liberal family on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. So, you know, politics was, you know, always something that was like discussed in our household. I would say like in terms of what like severed my belief that liberalism or that the Democratic Party was really on my side or like represented the things that I believed in was definitely the Iraq War and the entire war on terror and like the Bush years.
Right.
And it was seeing like, you know, not just like pretty much every Democratic politician, but also just like all the organs of what I thought was like, you know, the respectable liberal media, be it the New York Times or the New Yorker, or just all basically get on board for like George W. Bush and the war on terror and invading Iraq.
Yeah.
And then like that to me when I was like, okay, like something about what I believed is incorrect or it's just not adding up or like these people are not on my side.
So if anti-war sentiment is kind of the catalyst for becoming politicized in some capacity, in which direction did you go? What kind of material did you seek out?
In college, I guess I just started like seeking out voices that were, you know, had been branded as heretical or critical of liberalism, like, you know, like Counterpunch, for instance, like Alexander Coburn. But for me, it was kind of like the political blogosphere back when that was a thing, back when people had blogs, and it was just like, I don't know, just finding the opinions of people where I was just like, I read them and I was like, oh, this person's talking sense, or like this person is kind of, I don't know, cracked open a horizon of like, yeah, it's okay to hate Democrats and the people who vote for them.
So in some capacity, you are politicized by the alt media of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's happening a lot now on the internet. I've interviewed a lot of young people over the past few years who have become politicized through memes and videos and podcasts and basically moving through social media networks. But the affordances of that digital space are quite different than the blogosphere of previous generations, where in an attention economy, people will often comedically or satirically overstate their political positions. Right. And it can be hard to tell what someone means for real and what someone means as a joke. And sometimes they themselves may not be sure. How do you understand this media ecosystem? When do you think that someone needs to be taken seriously? When do you write something off as a joke? How do you parse this media landscape?
I mean, obviously, this is something I'm guilty of as well. So let me examine myself for the minute. obviously, like, humor and, like, through the guise of, like, irony or hyperbole sometimes is just simply how I kind of understand the world and can kind of metabolize it and communicate what I think to be true about it. That being said, like, if someone's not, you know, for, like to a mass audience, I kind of feel like if someone's not in on the joke or, like, you know, kind of fluent in the lingua franca of kind of, like, online politics or humor, like, then it be, yeah, that does become a question about, like, you know, what do you actually believe, or like, should I take this seriously, or are you just trying to wind people up for attention?
Yeah,
I think something is worthy of being taken seriously if you think it's funny. Like, I think if something is genuinely funny to you, or I think that's worthy of considering, like, what the serious thought behind it is, or if there is any serious thought behind it.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, art or politics, I think, like, part of becoming, I don't know, like, a mature or sort of self-confident in one's own beliefs is the ability to credit one's own, like, sense of taste and opinion. And I think, like, learning to do that is I think important, or it's, like, you know, I think it's what we should all aspire to, or, like, I would hope, like, in terms of, like, if what I've done has, like, inspired other people, I hope it's along those lines. But, like, the thing is, if I agree with something, I think I take the person saying it and what's being said seriously. And if I don't, I don't. And, like, then I think it's just up to, like I said, your own internal ideological or moral compass to figure out for yourself what people and ideas are worthy of taking seriously.
Well, it's impossible to mistake that a lot of the alt media ecosystem is dominated by comedians, like,
right,
literal stand-up, yeah, comedians, right? And there's some truth to this, that comedians can say truths that the rest of society can't. You know, a lot of these people are not, like, proper capital J journalists, mm-hmm, that went to journalism school. And there's something about, like, this approach and being able to satirize, you know, the kind of absurdities of our contemporary culture that resonates with a lot of people. Is that, though, a better way for people to become politicized compared to the maybe zines and blogs of the past?
When I used to work in the publishing industry, when I was an assistant editor, and I had to read, like, you know, manuscript submissions and determine, like, do I want to bring this to an editorial board? Do I want to tell my boss that this is worthy of taking a look at? Like, what would get me past that first two pages, or, like, the 9 times out of 10, like, the thing that would get me to a yes would be, does this make me laugh?
Yeah.
Do I discern a sense of humor here? And I think whether it is, like, you know, in that guise, or in making or advocating for a political point of view, or making a political point, or a sailing one, I think if you can make someone laugh, I think that's, like, that is so much. I think that's just so effective in kind of in communicating the point you're actually trying to make to someone.
And which of the two candidates we had in 2024 made more people laugh?
Well, Donald. Well, I mean, I don't know. Actually, that's hard to say, because Donald Trump is a more, like, a consciously funny person than Kamala Harris. And, like, you know, I mean, I think it's, like, probably his most effective political skill is just his ability to, you know, riff more or less unscripted for hours at a time. I mean, shit, I remember back when we went to CPAC years ago and saw him speak at the Gaylord Convention Center, and he went out there and just talked for, like, 2.5 hours. I couldn't believe it. Like, just solo.
Yeah.
Just solo talking. And, you know, obviously, like, the absurdity of it is also, like, you know, like to the point you're making earlier, like, it's a question of, like, how seriously should I take this?
Yeah.
And, like, and the absurdity of him and his humor, I think, like, it scrambles people's circuits in terms of, like, oh, like, he's not really serious about that. Or it's just, it's part of the spectacle. It's just, he's, a funny character on TV. And when we see someone we like on TV and on a TV show, we don't worry, you know, are they going to start World War III tomorrow?
In 2018, you wrote a book, The Chapo Guide to Revolution. To briefly kind of summarize the vision that's proposed in that book, this advocates for a 3 to 4 day work week, universal basic services, starting with single payer healthcare,
mm-hmm.
something that I would describe as social democracy within the limits of climate change and the existing carbon mm-hmm. budget. Most people approach this political program as being the product of running an insurgent campaign within the institution of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that 6 years later?
There is no insurgent campaign. The insurgents have been defeated. The surge worked.
Right.
The surge worked. And like, you know, if this last year has proven anything conclusively, it is the end of any kind of left liberal alliance in American politics. And or like, you know, I mean, or if you want to still pursue that, God bless you, but like, don't have any illusions about it. Because, you know, they spent the last year, you know, doing a Holocaust in front of everyone's eyes and, right. and have like, you know, basically would rather lose an election than not do that. So, I mean, and we saw what happened in 2020. It's just like, I just have to go back to like the messaging follows the policy.
Yeah.
And
lead with policy.
I think like, yeah, like start with universal healthcare or at least Medicare for all.
Hmm.
There are any number of popular and good policies that I think the thing is you have to actually believe in it.
The skepticism of AOC, you said you were biting your tongue before. How far back does that go? Is there a certain event that comes to mind when you became more skeptical of her positions?
I remember being impressed by her win, and I was just like, well, better have her there.
Sure, yeah.
And because, you know, someone who has sort of a bit of national profile and like, could articulate, for instance, like I think a politics that was in opposition to the mainstream currents of the Democratic Party and could begin being like an adversary, but be an adversary that couldn't be easily dismissed because she has, you know, such a safe seat and also like enough national profile that if she says something, like the media will follow it. And that like, but I guess like my skepticism came from like my larger skepticism of the idea that you can change the Democratic Party by voting for them.
When you reflect on the Biden administration, I have immense criticisms of them, but I'm also willing to concede that in terms of serving the interests of labor, the Biden administration was a historic anomaly, at least in my lifetime. And there's also some legislation that is an important departure from neoliberalism. Infrastructure Act, Inflation Reduction Act, CHIPS Act, things like this that back away from the kind of free market policies that have dominated American political consensus for the last 40 years. How do you feel about Joe Biden's approach and support for labor during his administration? And do you expect any of those policies to continue under Trump?
Golf claps for Joe Biden. but like, you know, if he hadn't carried out a genocide, I guess I could look at him as being like, hey, he's the most pro-labor president in my lifetime, which is also sort of like being the world's tallest dwarf. You know, like it's not exactly a high bar to clear, but if he delivered the New Deal Part 2 or even like a fraction of Johnson's Great Society, hey, I might be able to look the other way on the Holocaust he did. But given that he didn't do that, I'm sorry, I don't give a shit. I really don't. And I think, like, honestly, like, to the extent that of like the things you're talking about, like that he did cut against a sort of like a neoliberal consensus, I think that's just a knock-on effect of how fucking old he was.
Really?
I think he came into politics before the neoliberal turn in the 70s. So I think he just has like some vestigial, neurons, neural connections in his head that run on a different operating system. And to the extent that that's true, I'm still not going to give him credit or like congratulate him on any of this shit because too little, too late. I mean, good for him. Second question, though, no, I don't expect any of this to continue under Donald Trump or any other American president.
How do you expect Trump to act with Israel?
Trump at least has the instinct not to be seen as a loser or a pussy. And so like to that, like, you know, if I was trying to be such an optimistic outcome here, I would imagine maybe he would not, for all the money we give them, pissing down our leg and humiliating, or just like, you know, putting this country, so we say, in an awkward position, and forget international, our own law, but just like when we say something and be like, this is America's policy, and then they just tell us to go fuck ourselves.
Right.
You know, like that makes us look weak. And I don't think Donald Trump likes looking weak. But again, this is an optimistic scenario here. I think much more likely is that the policy will continue exactly as it has been before, yeah, of unlimited carte blanche for, you know, our imperial proxy in the Middle East. And I don't see that changing. Israel loves Donald Trump more than any other country on the planet. More people in Israel support Donald Trump than as a higher percentage of their population than they do in this country. So like, I don't know what incentive he would have to change course.
There's a strange thing that's happening, that the pronouncements of all of these, you know, so-called trustworthy institutions are just meaningless to the public, right? And there's this pervasive sense that the law is now a political instrument. There's not equality before the law, before the state, and so on. And so, you know, when Biden's in power, he uses it as he chooses. And right, when Trump's in power, he uses it as he chooses. What does that say for the legitimacy of the liberal regime when seemingly most people believe that the law is a political tool?
Nothing good. I mean,
not a good development.
I think now with a second term of Donald Trump, we're going to see like a new era of not just like the absolute looting of like what remains of the public sector or public good or public institutions, and just a fire sale of any even like remainingly barely legitimate or functional government. Trump is going to pardon Eric Adams. Yeah. That is going to happen. Whether Eric Adams will be reelected mayor is another thing. But like, here's the thing. I think the thing is like, liberalism as like the, you know, like as forever having to play the you know, cast themselves as the good guys of history. They preside over the same system, which like, as we were talking about, I think most people by now understand intuitively is totally corrupt.
Yeah.
And, you know, run by thieves and crooks and rapists. And I suppose now, like, say what you will about, like, a second Donald Trump term, but, like, I guess even when he got elected the first time, I thought the positive aspect of it is that no one in America, no one in our government or society can really pretend to believe otherwise about who America is and who we really are in this country. And as far as, you know, like entering a new era of just like open thievery and corruption, at least we don't have to pretend it's anything different. At least we don't have to pretend like, you know, there's anyone, you know, like that the white hats are coming to save us, or that like the if only we can return the ship of the, you know, the hand on the wheel of the ship of state to, you know, like the sober, serious party of the Democrats, who have just like, you know, all right, they're every bit as corrupt too, but it looks like they're not having any fun while they steal.
There's a lot of people now who are open to new narratives, right? The delegitimation of the existing system is making people go out online, look for new descriptions of the world, something that fits their experience. There's been a lot of talk about the need for a liberal Joe Rogan in the last few weeks. I seem to remember your podcast in particular catching a lot of heat for harmless jokes and emojis of some sort. What role does media play in political education and coalition building? What is the appropriate role of media in this case?
The appropriate role for media would be adhering to a strict party line determined entirely by myself and a few of my friends.
Okay.
I think that's the most important thing all media should do, and if they don't, they should be prosecuted, and their freedom of speech should be taken away. Freedom of speech only exists for me and people I approve of. I think like if we're trying to find a way out of this political situation we find ourselves in, it's take away the freedom and rights of people that I don't like or find annoying in any way. The media's traditional role has been to kind of create a consensual reality. That consensus is in now a decade into being completely obliterated. And, you know, we're in the hour of the wolf now, so just have fun. Just get out there and, you know, just whatever. And the further breakdown of institutional legitimacy is hopefully will translate to more money for Chapo Trap House Enterprises.
What you mentioned this consensus before. What held it together, let's say, 10, 20, 40 years ago, whenever it was, you know, relatively less fragmented than it is now?
You know, like you go back to say like that we're kind of the same age, or it's just like that end of history moment in the 90s where I think pretty much if you were of a certain class or education level in this country, everyone kind of felt like, yeah, there are problems in the world and there are problems in our country and there are historical problems that we're still attempting to rectify. But it was just the answer that the problems have pretty much been worked out. And it's just a problem of like, you know, it's just, we're just getting to that point. We're just like, we're eventually going to get there, but things are going to be, continue to be like increasingly peaceful, prosperous, and just like, and normal. And then like, and the entire 21st century has been like a savage refutation of that.
Right. History is happening again. A lot of today's left is led by elite academies, universities, institutions, nonprofits, things like this. What do you think the role of universities and academia is for a political movement on the left?
A graveyard? I don't know. I'm against all nonprofit organizations. I think if you're on the left, you should be making profit, baby. I think it's about making money. I don't know. No, I mean, like that's a glib answer because, like, you know, I'm not opposed to education. Like, I credit the education I received with, you know, what I do for a living now. A society that like ours that has devalued not just education overall, but I think particularly like the humanities is a society that's like not really interested in, I don't know, like replicating itself, or is not really capable of a democratic society. But that being said, like academia as it currently exists is like I don't see any future of left politics or any productive politics coming out of that, because like I don't know, like. My attitude is like, once you graduate college, you should stop thinking about college. To the extent to which like the left is associated with universities or just like the culture wars are still being like people who are into their 30s caring about college or talking about college, I just find very tiresome.
I mean, I'm conflicted about this because I'm involved in universities and I support the need for a humanities education. I got one myself. But I also feel that to a large degree, these elite academies are just irreparably controlled by finance and big donors. And
yeah, I mean, they're just like the Democratic Party.
Right.
I mean, they're like the Democratic Party itself. And like, look at the way like Columbia and the Ivy League dealt with the Palestinian solidarity encampments. I mean, like, I think that showed you there the limits of like their project, which is to mint the next generation of, you know, of political leaders and the ruling class, the people who are going to, you know, like manage the liberal capitalist state. And of course, like, you know, in the context of self-expression, political activism, being a engaged citizen of the world, and like that the university is a modern agora in which like even, you know, controversial matters or like people where students are like not expected to just study the world, but like live and engage in the world, et cetera. I mean, we've all read the brochures. But, you know, we see what happens when, like, on this issue, when they to peacefully protest a, you know, a war being funded by our own government and by many of the, trustees and, you know, institutions that support these universities as well. We saw how quickly that was done away with. So, I mean, I think that should give you an indication about how productive the university is, or like it just. I think it is overwhelmingly hostile to anything that would actually a politics or any vision that might actually I don't want to say even challenge, but I would just say even like confront or just, I don't know, disagree with the prerogatives of U.S. empire and capitalism.
Is woke over?
No, woke's actually coming back.
Woke is back?
Yeah, woke is back in a big way. And get in on the ground floor now, because by this time next year, if you're not woke, then you will be going broke. No, I mean, woke. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, of course it's fucking over. We elected Donald Trump president a second time. If that, like, I mean, woke is just like, it's just a slur that the right uses. Right. I mean, like, yes, it describes something real. And like, believe me, that I've found myself on the outskirts of many times as well. Hmm. Woke has become, and like, you know, like the left or liberals or whatever have certainly done themselves no favors. And they're partly responsible for this. But you got to understand, we're in a world now where like, anything that is not openly racist or is like anything that's not openly racist and repellent, that's woke. Hmm. So, I mean, to the extent that like anyone in this country is interested in, you know, not living in a world of just like outright hatred and bigotry and like, you know, racial essentialism, then like, yeah, like, which I certainly don't think is the majority of people in this country. I mean, like that's woke. So, and here's the other thing, the anti-woke people are the people like who are obsessed with it. Like they stared into the abyss too long. And the thing is like, you always attack in others what you see in yourself, which is like, you know, a very, very strong streak of humorlessness and a desire to censor and punish other people, which has been the bread and butter of, you know, reactionary movements since, you know, that was a thing. And I don't expect them to change. They're just going to institute their own political correctness and seek to punish or ostracize anyone who falls outside the boundaries of it.
Yeah, we saw a weird spike in that kind of activity, I believe, around October 8th.
Right. Well, I mean, like even outside
students, faces
even outside of, you know,
trucks,
like Zionism or like the, you know, like, and just like the outright removal of freedom of speech, certainly in academia, but also in like the workplace and elsewhere. But I'm talking about like, you know, like the right wing in this country, they're the ones that are literally like banning books from libraries right now. Mm-hmm. They're trying to like remove the ability, not just of like their kids to read a book about, you know, a gay penguin or whatever, but to remove the abilities of everyone's kids and every adult to do the same in this country. They have their own speech codes and their own ways that are like, you know, it's just a similar political project, except it's like, if you don't say the N word, that's actually, then you're on the outskirts of that. Mm.
I mean, it is staggering just in the last few years of just how explicitly mask off and racist a lot of these like content creators on the far right have become, that before they at least had the wherewithal to kind of conceal their politics to a degree.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I think they, and I think like they're, you know, in any political project, like especially ones on like the radical outskirts of what's considered like acceptable in the consensus reality, you're always looking to kind of, test the waters and like, sort of put your toe on that line. And I think with Donald Trump is like people respond to a leader, like any political movement needs a leader. And I think with Donald Trump and his success has given people kind of like a green light or a permission to kind of like push that boundary a little bit more and keep pushing it.
There's back for a moment to this question of elite institutions and this kind of maximalist rhetoric. There's kind of a weird alignment right now, at least on the level of rhetoric, where when I go to, you know, a radical, like anarcho-communist reading group, there's this similar policing of language as there is in elite academies that are supported by billionaires. And mm-hmm. those people have very different class positions and class interests. But from the perspective of the right and a lot of these, you know, anti-woke critics, they tend to lump those two groups in together. And I'm curious about why this kind of maximalist rhetoric that comes from, you know, anarchist, activist types, is so conveniently deployed in these elite academies.
Like, give me an example. Like, what do you mean by like
when people will, they'll use language like decolonization, you know?
Oh, right.
So I'll go to an anarchist reading group and we'll have, you know, long form discussions about that. But then I'll be in a college that costs $50,000 a semester and they're using a lot of the same language. In some cases, they're reading the same books. There is this weird kind of like at either end of this extreme disparity of wealth spectrum, people are kind of using a similar politics. Do you see some type of convenience behind that, or why is it deployed in both of these contexts?
My guess would be is because it's ineffective and pours your mind into a cul-de-sac that you want to talk about, like being unable to communicate to a broader public or do anything useful. I think that's where this kind of shit leads. So, I mean, like to the extent that it's like, if it's been successful at wrecking any anarchist or socialist group or commune throughout history, it should be just as good as doing that for anyone who goes to college.
Yeah, I think if there's a Thomas Frank wrote a piece shortly after the election, and it begins with his trip to the Smithsonian Museum, where he's reading what I believe is the wall text for something like a painting of George Washington crossing the Delaware or something like this. And it refers to the United States as like settler colonialism. Uh-huh. And he thinks to himself, you know, Trump is going to win in 2024. Yeah. That there is something about this kind of maximalist rhetoric that can alienate like the broad coalition that you would need for a social democratic majority. And I think there's a kind of utility there that elite academies can kind of pluck from the political fringe and then deploy to basically alienate everyday people who aren't like hyper wealthy and educated.
And the settler colonialism thing is so funny because like it does seem to me that like it's even more like feverishly pitched at a time when like our settler colonial Zionist client state manages to, like I said, like be providing an object lesson in what settler colonialism actually is.
Right.
But like because of that, like, well, we can't, that must not be addressed or noticed whatsoever. So we have to bring it back all back on ourselves about like, oh, actually America's a settler colonial like empire and like we're the legacy of settler colonialism, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not even saying that's not true, but it just seems to me like, yeah, like one of these, I can't help but think of it as anything other than like a conscious strategy to just confuse and mystify and denude any kind of radical critique or argument that, I don't know, is capable of, I don't know, at least speaking some sort of truth about the world we live in.
Yeah. To what percentage do you attribute Kamala's loss to things like inflation, grocery prices, for example, or just the outright genocide that's being committed now?
Well, I'm going to attribute it all to the Palestinian. I'm going to attribute it all to the genocide Israel did. Mm. And you know, I mean, I'm being glib here. Like, you look at the polls, and yeah, like obviously it's not at the top of the list here, but like it's certainly in the conversation. And look, when it comes down to it, I think like what played a factor in this election to say that what has been happening to Gaza this last year played no factor whatsoever in Kamala's loss is cap, as far as I'm concerned. And I think people are, you know, like they're willfully lying to themselves and everyone else about that. Because here's the thing. Do I think it was the decisive factor? Maybe, maybe not. But like it was the decisive factor in making it basically impossible for anyone with a conscience to vote for her, or at least vote for her and be proud about it, or tell anyone, or work for her, or call people on the phone, or canvass for her.
Yeah.
And I think at the end of the day, when people remember Joe Biden's presidency, to the extent that they remember it at all, they'll remember, you know, his senior moments. They'll remember him turning the country over to Donald Trump for a second time. But I think like if they remember anything about it, they will remember him the same way they remember Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam. And they will, like, you know, they will, this will be the footnote to his entire 4 years in office is that, like, he, you know, more or less, like, not just looked the other way, but was, like, the proximate reason why, you know, Israel was able to commit, genocide on, like, you know, some of the most horrific war crimes that people have seen every day for a year now, unbroken, and continue to.
Every day, yeah. Yeah, I mean, maybe a few years ago, I would have said that there's a political organization to join, but I don't feel that way now, you know? I don't feel like there's a functional political organization that I want to funnel people into. So I have less and less of an answer for this question. But I think that, I guess the way that I've phrased it in the past, and this is inspired to some degree by Amber's book, is the idea, what do you want to do when socialism is won, right? It's like, what are you fighting for? And in some cases, if you are living for revolution, that's not great for your mental health all the time, to be struggling towards a goal that is not possible to achieve within maybe your lifetime, maybe the next few years, certainly not the next weekly news cycle. But then let's say you did win, like, what do you do? You know, are you going to go for a walk?
I mean, hopefully
with your
family? I would be appointed some sort of like Stalinist cultural censor. Where I'd be in charge of, like, you know, deciding what movies get made and what authors get put in prison, who gets sent to re-education camps and something like that. That's hopefully, I mean, this is what I'm working for, right? So, I mean, hopefully that'll be the big payoff at the end of all of this.
the czar of the Ministry of Culture in the future.
Ministry of TV and movies.
Yeah.
Hopefully President Xi, if you're watching this, I'm ready. I'm available. Put me in, coach. I'm ready to play. We are preparing the ground for you in this country. We are ready to collaborate. And just, let's link and build, brother. Let's do it.
I mean, you're joking, but there recently was an announcement from the CCP that they are now funneling money into film production specifically. That's why I asked this.
You know, we do have a production company.
Link and build.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not a geopolitics guy. I'm not like a China guy, but like just as someone who watches the game, you know, it'd be hard for me to make a case that China isn't going to come out of this century as the number one player on the planet Earth. And you know, and why shouldn't they?
I mean, I'm inclined to agree. Step one is banning TikTok, which will most likely have happened by the time this episode goes out. So we'll see where it goes. Will, thank you so much. Your work is an inspiration. You inspired a lot of us, and your work is immensely important, and I'm very grateful for it.
I'm sorry.
And I appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.